You're listening to Alternative Future Radio, home of the weird, resting place of the paranormal. We'll take you to the furthest reaches of the galaxy and beyond. Strange phenomena, aliens, psychics, cryptozoology, conspiracy, holistic health, and UFOs. Alternative Future Radio, where spooky just got weird.
Good morning, everybody. We're welcoming back an old guest today, a very special guest with a story out of this world you will not believe, but it is somehow believable.
The Out There Hour on Alternative Future Radio. The Out There Hour with Basil and Mark. www.alternativefutureradio.com.
We dropped off the edge.
Yeah, sometimes we do. Good morning, Basil.
Good morning, Mark.
And good evening, everybody else.
Africa,
Middle
Europe,
East,
Australia.
Ramadan Karim, if it's still Ramadan where you were.
America, we're quite big in America.
Yeah, we're all right. We do well.
I should mention that.
We do well.
And the Ukraine, because we get hacked from there.
We do often. Like to get a bit of a hack from the Ukraine. Our guest today has been hacked recently as well.
Yeah,
I'm not sure from the Ukraine, but, you know.
We've suffered it all on them. Hack attacks for probably about 3 weeks now.
Well, that we know of.
Yeah.
They've probably been trying for a while, but they were only successful for the first time a couple of weeks ago. And since then, I've been logging things and... They're pretty persistent.
This is an interview that people have been waiting for since part one.
Yeah.
It caused quite a bit of interest.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a
very, very interesting character, our guest today.
Labour councillor Simon Parkes from Whitby.
Whitby, yeah.
And his total recall of alien encounters.
Basically, the story so far. Shall we do the story so far?
Yes, please.
Well, his mother... when he was a small child, I believe he was raised just by his mother. She was doing, what should we call it, typing, admin, typing up documents for...
MI5.
MI5.
I think MI6.
It's hard to know. He was only a child, maybe we're not sure.
Okay, slightly unusually. She was doing this not in an office, but actually in her own home.
At home.
Which it does happen.
It is weird, but
it does happen.
And they were classified documents, weren't they? They were top secret.
Yeah.
They were written on them top secret.
Above top secret.
Yeah.
Ooh. And a little Simon,
yes.
Curious little boy,
yes,
had a little nosy into these files.
You start reading them.
Behind his mother's back, where you start to see some very unusual things.
Very weird, very strange.
Stuff about time travel.
Yeah, aliens.
The Nazis.
Yeah. They're in everywhere. We can't go an episode without mentioning the Nazis.
And also... part one of the interview, I mean, there was so much in it with family history.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
It transpired that what other people hadn't quite seemed to uncover, but we did.
Oh, we did.
His grandfather also was a Secret Service.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of family history there, obviously.
And also a member of the UN Council.
Yeah. Blimey.
And an envoy.
Connected much?
Envoy to Germany during World War II.
Ooh.
And I think there was, he mentioned something about, not that the grandfather was a Mason, but there was, he knew of them.
A Masonic link, shall we say?
Yeah, there was a Masonic link there.
Yeah.
But you need to go back to our previous interview.
Yes, go to alternativefutureradio.com and you can see the old interview there. You just search for Simon in the search bar, you'll find it straight away.
So,
and there's some pictures there that he drew as a child of some of his experiences, which hopefully you'll describe today.
That's the point. We didn't even get...
We billed him as talking about UFO, alien contact. Didn't even get to that.
Yeah.
We'll just talk about his family history. It was fascinating.
I mean, his alien contact actually started from the crib.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very young, yeah.
And that's what we're going to be talking to Simon about today.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the full description of being on board a craft, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. He's got countless drawings. We've got some up on his Simon Parkes page on the alternativefutureradio.com website. You can see some of his pictures. They're all hand-drawn, aged sort of, you know, 5 and 4 and 30. You know, it's like an ongoing thing, apparently.
I want to ask him about that. I want to ask him, are the aliens that he encountered like some of the things maybe we've seen on television and films?
Yeah, yeah. There are some drawings. Some of them look pretty terrible, to be honest. They look pretty horrific.
Yeah.
They look a bit like the Mothman. They're all sort of blurry and black and beady eyes and things.
He's got a picture of a control room of a UFO, and that
I think that's on the website.
That crops up quite often.
Yeah, yeah.
We see that quite regularly. We did mention to Simon in the last interview being somebody who was privy to secret information from MI5 and MI6, was there an attempt on his life? And he had a very interesting story.
He did. I think you should go back and listen to that.
It was very good.
Yeah, we can't recap everything. Shall we get him on?
Yeah, let's get him on.
Radio.
People are waiting for this.
Live now, over to Whitby, traditional Yorkshire greeting, A up, Simon.
Oh. Hello, Mark, and hello, Basil.
Well, we've got you back on the show again. Basil, we had a hell of a time last time.
Yes.
Very detailed.
We've covered part one with Simon, his family history, very interesting family history, his mother and his father and their involvement in the Secret Services, MI5, MI6.
Lots of detail.
Your grandfather, Basil.
Your grandfather, sorry. Your grandfather, fascinating man. Absolutely fascinating. But what we really want to talk to Simon about was his own experiences.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to do today. And we're going to go back as far as you can remember, Simon, which is actually a very long way back. You have a good recall, to say the least.
Yes. I mean, before I go into that, maybe I could just say that... My memories, I would say a quarter of all my memories I've always had from a very young boy. But as I approached my 50th birthday, that was 2009, a great deal of memories came back. And I went through a period of about 18 months where I was getting 2 to 3 memories back a week. This is during the daytime. And then when I was home, I would have a paper and a pen. And I would just very quickly draw down in sort of cartoon fashion, storyboard fashion, what had happened and the dialogue, because within 20 minutes of remembering it, it would go, progressively go. So I've got actually hundreds of drawings that I've recorded over those 18-month period. And what was staggering, I think, for me was that the memories I'd always had from when they occurred from a small boy, which I'd rationalized away or just pushed to the back of my mind because I didn't want to be bothered with it. I couldn't cope with it. When new memories came back and I could think, oh, well, that's the memory I've had before. But I realized that those memories that I'd had from a small boy were only a part. I thought they were complete memories, but clearly they were only a part of them. So some people get memories back in their sleep. Some people do it under hypnosis. Mine have actually come back during the day, and it'd be sparked off by either seeing a bright colour or somebody on a radio show saying a key word. And then generally what I have to do is just quickly sit down and the memory will unfold. And then very, very quickly, as soon as that's finished, I just get the paper and I draw it down. So some of the memories that I'll recount to you today will be ones that I've always remembered, and others will be ones that come back over that 18-month period.
Simon, that is how most people have their memories jogged, though, isn't it? If you smell something or see a particular thing, it might remind you of a childhood memory where you went on a trip, that kind of thing. People, that is generally the usual way people would remember things that they have experienced and then forgotten, isn't it? It's fairly normal way of doing things.
I suppose so. The only thing that gets me is that why approaching my 50th birthday, you know, why did so many of those memories come back at that stage? Why didn't they come back when I was 40 or 30? Mm. So that's a bit I don't understand. But yes, you know, you might have a particular smell which reminds you of something a long distant past. So in the same way, that's true. Maybe I've just got to a point in my life where I can cope with this stuff, and therefore it's coming out now, whereas when I was younger, I was still in conflict.
So if you could start at the very beginning, Simon, as far back.
Yeah.
The first memory I have is very, very difficult for people to comprehend, because if you purely look at it from a human perspective, it's very hard to understand that you can have a memory before you were born. The first memory that I have, I'm actually in my mother's womb, and all I can remember is a face projecting in. Now, it's not projecting into the womb, it's clearly coming into my head. The face is like a traditional kite, like a child who flies a kite shape, pyramid inverted, 2 eyes, a nose, no features, no communication that I can remember. The feeling I get is suddenly being awake, suddenly realizing that there's a lot more to life than I realized, that I'm not alone. This great overarching feeling that life is so much more complicated, and then the face just goes and my memory goes. So, you know, a researcher would say that that was a soul-to-soul contact. So that's my earliest memory. Having been born, I have no memory of being born, anything like that. The next memory I have, probably between 3 months old and 6 months old, because I can't yet sit up. And I can remember being in a cot, and I can move my head from side to side, but I can't lift my head up, so I'm that young. And then movement to the right-hand side attracts my attention. I move my head to the right, and I can just see two legs. I think they're legs, but they look like sticks, green sticks. That's all I can see, and the next thing I know are two hands coming down into the cot, and I can actually look up, raise my eyes up, and there are two hands. They're not like mummy's hands. Mummy's hands are pink, and they've got five digits. These are green, and they have four digits, and they end in a point. And the hands come down, and I lose vision of them. They grab me by the waist. It doesn't hurt me. It's just firm, and I'm lifted out of the cot. And my head falls backwards because I've got no control over my head. I'm that young. And I can just remember seeing the ceiling. And I'm lifted up. And then I'm turned. And I remember as I'm turned, my head drops forward. And my chin bangs against my breastbone. Again, I'm too young to have control. And I'm looking straight into the eyes of what a researcher would call a mantid. And it's just an overall feeling of love. It's an overall feeling of this is your family. No communication that I can remember as such. And then there's a feeling of dropping into a well. If you drop a stone into a well, dark well, that's how I then felt, that I was falling into a dark well. And then that's the end of that memory. So those are the two earliest memories that I have.
Wow. I mean, it is, as you say, it is hard for most people to comprehend someone remembering something, never mind before you were born, but also when you were 3 to 6 months old, even that would be almost unheard of, one would say. Yes. It's certainly a difficult one, but again, if you didn't remember it at the time, you got the memory back later.
Yes.
Do you have any explanation as to why these... or how these memories are coming back to you? Do you think that they are actual memories, or are they projections of something, you know, that someone else or something else is projecting to you? How do you think this works? Because obviously, no normal human, for want of a better word, could remember anything from 3 months old. So if we assume that it happened, are they even your memories, or are they given to you?
That's a really interesting question, isn't it? I think that's why I prefer to call myself an experiencer rather than contactee or an abductee. I think that these things really happened. Certainly in later life, it might well be the case that the images are projected into your mind. It doesn't devalue it, because it means an external agency, an external force has come along, has projected something, and you experience that. I'm very, very weary of when I experience things in front of a viewing screen. Sometimes my experience is I'm placed in front of a big, like a television screen. And I'm very wary of anything that I experience there, because I think that's not real. That's projected into the mind. But undoubtedly, many of the experiences are real. I mean, for instance, when I've had experiences in later life, I found my glasses on the floor broken. And there's no explanation for that. If that wasn't a real physical happening, that wouldn't have occurred. I think that clearly, whether it's my own ability or that they're time-locking these memories, for some reason these memories were fixed into my mind, many of them locked away, and at a set time were going to be released and were going to come out. I don't know whether that's my own body protecting me by not allowing these memories to come out until such time as I was ready for it, or they deliberately want these memories to come out and they've keyed them in to come out at a set time. So the way the memories were put into my mind, or the experience, must have been so traumatic, or if not traumatic, must have been so unusual and so strong that the memories were not lost. They were maintained somewhere in the mind. Because you're absolutely right. Most people would not have a memory from such a young age. But then they haven't been interacted with by interdimensional or extra-dimensional beings. If you... You have a one-year-old who has a birthday and mum makes him or her a cake. That one-year-old is unlikely to remember that cake because that's a standard memory with everything else. But if an extraterrestrial or an interdimensional being makes some form of contact, then we can imagine that if they want you to remember that memory, they're able to do something. So at this stage of the game, I would say some of my memories are very real physical memories and some are definitely projected.
Simon, I want to just break for an advertisement. Then, when we come back, I want to ask you if this has got any relevance to your childhood experiences with your parents. We're just going to break for a quick advertisement, then we'll be right back. Okay, so we are back again with Simon Parks. Experiencer is the term he uses to describe his experience with non-terrestrials, we'll say at this stage, because we don't really know the ins and outs of who, what and where. Simon, you were just describing your earliest experiences, age minus
we got up to
6 months.
Up to 6 months.
Yeah. Simon, just before you go on with your next recollection, do you think there is a connection between your experience and the work that your mother did that we discussed in the previous interview? Unless you want to cover that towards the end, it's up to you.
Well, you've asked the question now, and if I don't answer it now, I probably will forget.
Fair enough.
I undoubtedly now, looking back on it, of course there was. My mother engaged in as we talked before, and worked with MI5, odd people coming to the house, looking at crashed craft retrieval, special documents, grandfather in MI6. It would be special pleading, I think, to imagine that there was any sort of coincidence. If you come from a background of a family like that, and it's not surprising, therefore, that a child, I was the single child, the only child, would have those sort of contacts. So I'm not at all surprised. At the time, I didn't even think about it. When you're growing up, there's so many other things that you're involved in. All I knew was, and we'll get onto it later, that I had these special friends that would come and visit me. But yes, looking back on it now, there can be no doubt. You can't grow up in a family where espionage is lived, breathed, and talked about every 2 minutes and not have some strange things happen to you.
We'll try this chronologically. We've gone up to 6 months.
Okay.
Can you remember the next time?
Yes. I'm old enough to sit up now, so I must be around about 1 year old. And there are what I would describe as three little grey men walking round me. But they're not like your Hollywood little grey men. These ones do not have the big wraparound eyes. These have small eyes, but great, really strange at the lids of their eyes, both bottom and top, look like rhinoceroses. The skin is grey, it's wrinkly like an elephant or a rhinoceros, but not as thick. And the heads bulge at the back, very odd. And of course, being greys, they don't walk like humans. They have a very different way of walking. And there are three of them, and I'm sitting on the floor, and I look up my head, and I can't remember why I look up, but I look up, and I appear to see my toys floating above my head. And there's some soldiers and a steam engine and some building blocks, you know, the blocks of wood with A, B, C, D, and the numbers on them. And they're floating above my head, travelling in a circle. I can't remember now without looking at the notes whether it's clockwise or anti-clockwise. And I reach up to try to touch my toys, but they're too far above my head. And then the toys change and they go into shapes. Imagine a plate glass window, and you lay the plate glass window on the ground, then you take a big stone and you smash the window into hundreds of sharp, jaggedy bits. Then I want you to imagine that you were to push the jaggedy bits back, so it's sort of back in the shape of a window, but there are gaps between each jaggedy bit of glass. And then I want you to imagine that you paint each piece of jagged glass a bright colour, purple, orange, green, mauve, yellow, all those bright colours. And that's above my head, but instead of flat as a pane glass window. It's like a football. It's all gone into a circle, and it's all spinning above my head. One of the little green grey men says to me in my mind, look, feel, understand. I were the three words, look, feel, understand. And that's the memory that I have of that. Then there are several others which are fairly bizarre, and I won't go into that. But one later life would be a shadow being. I didn't call him a shadow being. That's what researchers call him. I've always called him my smoke man.
Because I saw this. Simon, we've got some pictures on our website, alternativefutureradio.com, that you drew at various points in your life, and I've seen that particular picture, and it's right. A very menacing-looking being. It looks very much like the Mothman, almost.
It's also something that people mention quite a bit, that they've experienced the shadow people.
When people think of E.T. experience, they think greys and...
Sometimes it's connected to sleep paralysis.
Really?
At times. But not with you, Simon.
Well, I've always called him the smoke man because he appears to have like smoke coming off his body. Mm. But the smoke doesn't just disappear like it would off a chimney. It just never seems to grow. So if you imagine maybe a foot of smoke coming off his arm, it just doesn't get any longer. It just like floats. So the memory I have, I'm in flat A, 37 Preston Park Avenue, where I lived with my mum for many years. And I see an angel, or looks like an angel, floating down the hallway. But it's very strange because it's a ball about the size of a grapefruit, and it appears to have what looks like a chicken's head coming out the top of it and stubby wings. But in my mind, I appear to think it's an angel. And I follow this ball, and it goes into the bedroom, and then it disappears. And then through the window, I see this smoke man. He's actually the other side, outside, and he looks like a load of rags. If you took loads of old oily rags, think of lots of old rags that you've done cleaning your motor car engine, you tie them all together, and you get some black refuse sacks, and you tie them all together. And he's like that. He's floating. He's off the ground, and he's just floating. So although in my memory this appears to be the first time I've met him, because I've no earlier memories of this being, it isn't the first time, because I've got some sort of recognition protocol with him, and I hold my arms out to my sides like Jesus on the cross, and he does the same. So we've recognized each other, and then he basically floats right through the window. There's no smashing of the glass. The glass doesn't go watery. There's no sound as he passes through the window. He just passes right through the window. He doesn't walk. He just sort of glides in and stops about 3 foot in front of me. And then the next part of the recognition protocol is I raise my hands right above my head, and he does the same. Then, for want of a better word, like an electric arc jumps from one of his hands to the other hand, and then he passes that to me. So I'm standing there with my hands above my head with what looks like this sort of energy going from one hand to the other. And I learned later that this is some sort of a locking device. It prevents any other being coming to me and interacting with me. So we're almost energetically linked. He can only interact with me and I with him. It's like a tumbler lock. That's how it was described to me. So that nobody else can break in and interfere with this program. So when that's done, I say to him, who are you? And he says, I'm your, they say teacher or doctor. Do you know, I can't remember. He says, I'm a teacher or doctor. He says, I've come to make you better. And I say to him, am I sick? And he said, no, not better as in sick, but I'm come to make your mind better. And that's the only...
Mm-hmm.
What happens is I have to copy him. So he stands in front of me and he raises an arm. And this arm has no fingers on the end of it. There's no hands. It just goes to a point like a spike. And he raises the hand up and he's black, smoke-like, two red eyes, no nose, no mouth, a pointed head with several other lumps on his head, no mouth, no teeth, no physical features, just this black strangeness. And I raise my hand up. So if you imagine a clock face and he holds his hand up to say 2 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I have to raise my right hand up to 2 o'clock. And then he might put his hand down to 6 o'clock, and I'll do that. Then his other hand will come up and go to 9 o'clock, and I'll match him. And he gets faster and faster and faster. So he's moving his hands really quickly, and I'm having to copy him. After a while, he takes his hands down and mentally tells me that he's going to send me images of where his hands are going, and I have to copy him. So he's standing there with his arms down by his sides, and I'm furiously going with my arms left and right, all the different points of the compass, because he's telling me where his arms were. The last part is the hardest part to grasp. It's extremely complex. Now, he still stands there with his arms down by his sides, and he says to me, I want you to put your hands, I want you to put your arms where my arms would go if I would move them. In other words, he no longer tells me in my mind where his arms are going to go. But if he was to tell me where his arms were going to go, I would have to know where they were going to go and put my arms. And I'm going crazily, moving my arms into positions that I think he would have put his arms had he done it.
Yeah.
And this went on for about off and on for between 3 months and 6 months. And my schoolwork absolutely suffered. I was at primary school, and they were so worried about me at school that I got a special teacher every lunchtime after I finished my meal, because it was about an hour and a half. So after half an hour, and I would go and have a one-to-one with a class teacher who would help me to read, particularly reading and maths. And my grandfather, my human grandfather, was so worried about me through my mother that a special teacher came on a Sunday to the house and taught me. And so when I interacted with this being, my traditional education skills went absolutely down the toilet. And then after this six-month period was over, the opposite happened. It was really weird. My reading skills went up. I think I was about 5 or 6. I only just started primary school, and I had a reading age of 12.
Interesting. Simon, one question that I think is worth asking. If you were in this state, able to read telepathically what this smoke man was going to do, the question is, when you were back in your normal human state, back in control of your own functions, could you still do it?
Not in the same way. I mean, it's a joke in the family now. I mean, I have children, you know, from a previous relationship. And it's a great joke with my wife now and with my children that when we play cards, they joke to me to say, turn it off. Because nobody will play cards or anything like that, because I have an uncanny ability to know what those cards are. So it's always a family joke with that. I've always held jobs where I've managed people. So I've had a skill of what you might call being empathetic with people, so being able to understand people and problems. So in all the jobs I've had, which have basically been with local government, I've held posts where I've managed staff and overseen projects where people will come to me and say, well, this is an insurmountable project. Sort it out.
It's probably worth pointing out, Simon, for the new audience who didn't see the first interview, which I think they should definitely go back and listen to before they listen to this one, that you are a sort of fully functioning normal member of society. You're a Labour councillor and a driving instructor, I hope you don't mind me saying, and you're leading a normal life. You're not living in a shack up a mountain or anything like that. You're pretty normal. For want of a better word.
I don't know what's normal. I know what you mean. Certainly, I mean, I'm an elected politician. I am and have been, you know, in London, and I am now. I have a sort of normal job. I have a normal relationship. And I think that's what makes it very difficult for the powers that be, because when you have somebody that's credible and is prepared to come out and say this stuff, it's very, very difficult for the powers that be to know how to deal with that person. And the usual reaction is to try and turn some arms of the media against you and try to debunk you and rubbish you. You know, no, I don't live on a mountain. I do have a fairly normal life. And the only reason that I'm able to do that is because these beings or creatures, whatever you want to call them, have visited me from such an early age that I know no different. Many people I speak to say, oh, can you have a word with them for me, please, and ask them to come and visit me? And I say, are you serious? And I say, oh, yes, yes, you know, I really want them to come and visit me. And they have no concept. And that's why if you read Whitley Schreiber's book, where he talks about, in his books, where he's frozen solid when these ETs arrive and they won't let him move. And I think in one of the chapters he says he just manages to smile. They'll do that to humans because where a human is, in their view, unbalanced in terms of might lash out or attack them and could hurt them, they will actually lock that human down. And they'll do that because that human's not accepted them. But in my case, and perhaps in many other cases, where they've put in a huge amount of effort from a very, very small child with very regular visits, although it's odd and they're different and it's not the norm, you become so acclimatized to it that you don't go into the traditional human panic state. And that's why I cope with it. That's why I can have a normal life, because I know no different. If you get a 30-something or a 40-something adult or even a 20-something adult who then sees these things, they can't generally cope with it. And it's too hard for them because they're already in the paradigm of this world, what's real and what's not real. When you're a very small child, you don't know what's real and what's not real. So if a green creature comes to you and picks you up and is kind to you, well, that's part of your life. And if it regularly visits you, then you accept it. And when I was very young, I used to say to family and friends, well, I've got two mummies. And they didn't understand what I meant. I've got two mothers. And my very first words, this is fascinating, I've been told, my very first words were, I called my human mother Daddy.
How strange. How
the
strange.
Reason I call my human mummy daddy was because we haven't got to this bit yet, but the creature that the mantis creature that always associates with me came to me and said, I'm your mother.
Simon, so, we're just going to take a quick break and we'll get right back to that story, because okay. that's fascinating. Okay, well, we're back with Simon Park. Simon, you were just saying your first words were, remind us again.
My first words ever were the words daddy, and these words were said to my mother, who took it very well, apparently. It became rather difficult. You see, my father disappeared when I was only 3 months old. He left the family and never came back again, so I didn't have a father.
Can we just ask, Simon, when you say he disappeared, you mentioned that in part one of our interview. Did he just go away? Do we know that he was alive?
Yeah, he just went.
Okay, I'm just making sure he didn't disappear in the biblical sense.
No, he just went. I mean, I don't know. He just said that this wasn't for him, and he just left. And my mother never remarried and never had another boyfriend again.
Yeah, so Simon, I think it's worth asking, if he disappeared, with your family history being what it was, did he disappear or was he disappeared?
I don't know. I mean, I've only got... I don't even have it now. I was only ever shown one photograph of him and told a very brief history of him. And that's the way it was.
I'm assuming he existed, Simon.
Well, I presume so. I mean,
that's a hell of a question.
I've been shown a photograph of him, but it was just the subject that, you know, father walks out or leaves or whatever you want to call it when you're 3 months old and you never ever have a contact with that person again, and it's never mentioned, then it's not part of your life, is it?
But I suppose for all we know, he could have been removed, assassinated,
possibly. All I know is that he was no longer there,
redeployed.
I somewhat wonder what he did.
I don't know. I mean, the subject matter was never discussed at home. It wasn't something to be talked.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Just accepted it.
So, Simon, you were saying that your first memory was calling your mother daddy. Well, what did that mean? Why would you have called her daddy? Did you ever get to the bottom of it?
No, because it's something that just families just have a laugh and joke about. I mean, I know now that it's because if this other being, and if there is actually an article on the internet, it's very hard to find, but there's some chap who'd done a survey of mantis, as the Americans call them, because it tends to be mostly American research.
Yeah.
And he'd found that by trawling through personal reports, that a number of children had reported a green bug-type creature who had come to it and either said it was its grandmother or its mother or its sister. And I think in human life, we respect the female. The child is nurtured by the mother. And so it's not so unusual for an alien to come and doesn't say, I'm a great big green alien. Boo. What it says is, I'm your mother. And I'm going to give you a memory of that in a minute. But so there is research out there. I did Google it, where it showed that a number of young children had reported interaction with exactly the same sort of being, the mantis being, and in each case it had attempted to pass itself off as a female member of the family in order to gain the trust of that child. So there is actually a precedent there. That's very interesting. Can I just quickly go on to that memory, because that's the one that caused all the excitement.
Yeah, go on.
Right, well, I've always remembered this part ever since I was 3 and a half. So we're talking now 1963. I know it's 1963 because in 1962, Mum and I lived in Notting Hill in London. And in 1964, we moved to flat A, 37 Preston Park Avenue. So it had to be 1963. And this memory I've always had, but I've just rationalized it away and just forgotten it. I tried to forget it until I got to about 50. And the memory was this. I'm in this little flat. It's a house divided into flats. And I don't know where my human mother is. I've no idea. Frankly, I don't care because I'm glad. I'm 3 and a half years old. I'm glad she's gone. I don't really want her. I'm left on my own, and it's really nice. She annoys me, and I'd really rather she wasn't there. That's my feeling at 3 and a half years old. Suddenly, what I've always called him as my star man. Now, when I say a star man, I don't mean a spaceman from the stars. I mean a silver looking man, thin, with pointy arms and pointy legs, just appears to walk straight through the wall. Just appears to come straight through. And I look at him and I start crying. Not surprising, really. And I get the feeling from the creature that it's actually perplexed as to why I'm upset by seeing him. It is a male, definitely got a male personality. And I become more and more tearful. And in front of me, he changes, and he changes into a policeman. So he's got a policeman's hat, traditional pointy hat, blue uniform. But the star on top of the hat, instead of the proper badge, it's just like if you've given a piece of tin foil and a pair of scissors to a six-year-old kid and said, cut me a star. It's like really weird, childish star stuck on his head. But the real problem was his face. His face took on the persona of a lion. Now, I don't mean with whiskers and like cat ears at the top. It's a very human-looking face. But the ears, if you imagine your own ears, but move them 3 centimetres higher up your head, a much longer face. So it had what I'd call a cat-looking face, although it was definitely humanoid. And, you know, to a 3 and a half-year-old kid, to see what looks like a cat in a policeman's uniform is just too much to take. So I become hysterical, and I run towards the door of the sitting room to get out. And this creature just glides. It doesn't run. It just glides at a super fast speed and cuts me off. So now I'm hysterical. And then I go and run and hide behind the sofa, and I curl up into the fetus position. And then I have no more memory at that point. No more memory. And I didn't discuss it with my mother when she came home or anything like that. And how I rationalized it through my teenage years and my adolescent years was that, well, I'll tell you what happened. Mum must have gone out for some cigarettes, left me at home. I started to cry. The neighbours heard me crying, called a policeman. The policeman kicks the front door in and comes and gets me. Well, that doesn't take account of the thing that walked through the wall. It doesn't take account of the fact that this thing changed into a sort of a cat shape. A policeman would have been talking to me and trying to calm me down. But it's memories like that, and that's how I've coped with them through all my adult life. I rationalise them into something that would sort of make sense. And once I'd done that, I just push them away to the back of my mind and never, ever try and think about it. Now, as I approach my 50th birthday, this memory came back, and I'll just add the little bit on. It all transpired in front of me, except the addition of one of the faces it changed into was a clown. And it sent me an image of a big top and lots of clowns all throwing custard pies at each other. And it could not understand why I was so hysterical. And I now know in later life, you know, these things don't they don't get the context. Loads of clowns in a big top with 100 kids all screaming and shouting is great fun. But something that walks through the wall and changes isn't funny. And so the clown was to make me laugh. It didn't work. The policeman was to make to reassure me. And that didn't work. So now I'm hiding behind the sofa. And then I suddenly hear a voice that I recognize. Excuse me. And the voice says, "Don't be scared. Nobody will harm you. Look at me. Don't be scared. You will never be hurt. It is not permitted to harm you. Look at me." So I recognize this voice, and the insistence here is I look. I raise my head up above back of the sofa, and I see a green hand, just like the fingers that had lifted me out the cot when I was very small, and is holding a silver stick. And I would say the stick's about a foot and a half long. And on the end of it is like a diamond. And it activates. And although it's not slow motion, it must have happened quickly. In my mind, it's like slow motion. The facets on the end of this go blue. Think of a diamond in a jeweler's shop, and then each facet suddenly going blue in a circle. Boom, 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 but quickly. And then a blue light shone straight into my face. The very next thing I can remember is floating. I'm actually floating out of the room, very gently, very slowly. I'm not at all scared. Then there's obviously a gap in the memory, because the next thing is I'm sitting in another room, excuse me, and this room is metal, totally metal. There's nothing in it except a sofa, the same sofa that I've been hiding behind. It's crazy. And I've got my back to the sofa. And it's going to sound very funny. There's no dust. In the house that I was living at, it was a Victorian, and it was very dusty. There's not a speck of dust here. And there's a dear old lady sitting to my left. And I've got toys down in front of me that I can play with. But the dear old lady, she's looks like a dear old lady, but her face changes. And it goes into a cat face, and then it goes back to a dear old lady's face, and it's just changing like this. And she's stroking my face. And I've talked about it, I think, before, where there's a rhythmic stroke. So she'll put her hand on my face, stroke it down, then wait, stroke it down again. And this is going on all the time. And then after a while, I think, well, where's my mum? You know, where's my mummy? So I say, well, where's mummy? And as soon as I say that, the old lady points and says, "There's your mummy." And I look to my left, and sure enough, there's my mother, or appears to be my mother. But as I look at my mother, her whole body changes, and it's the mantid. And he's standing there in a purple robe, and, you know, God, he's tall, he's really tall, and then suddenly changes back to my mother. And every time I'm shown the image of my human mother, I get a message in my head, and the message is, "This is your mother." That's fine. That sounds reasonable. And then when the mantid comes on, I get the message, "But this is your real mother, your more important mother." And this image keeps flashing, but the length of time that my human mother's image stays up gets less and less. And the length of time that the mantid's on is more and more. And then suddenly I just jump up, run towards this mantid when he's in his mantid shape, and say, "Mummy, mummy, mummy, come and look at my toys." And the elation in this being, because I've accepted him in his mantid form and referred to him as my mother, and he bends right down, picks me up by the middle, lifts me right up, so I'm face to face with him, and he says to me, "You are special. You are truly loved." And then puts me down, and then we go off and do other things. But that's how I referred to him as mum, because he didn't give birth to me. He's not my mother. But he clearly came to me telling me that he was my mother, using psychological tricks or whatever you want to call it. And I accepted him. And the research that you can find on Google shows out of 10 times, 8 or 9 of those times, they fail. The human child rejects them. Now, for some reason, I accepted him. And that was the start of quite a lot.
Simon, for most people listening to that, it's going to sound unbelievable, really, is probably the only word I can use. I mean, old ladies with cat-like faces and policemen with unusual faces and...
Yep.
An angel ball with a chicken head. I wrote down earlier that
I've heard Simon.
It was. It's.
I've heard Simon's previous interviews. And every time, it's the very same.
Yeah.
Detail.
My point being is that most people who would experience something that you traditionally would hear of, shall we say, if there is a tradition, would be grey aliens, something being projected into their mind, that kind of thing. your story, your account, is so unbelievable that it couldn't possibly, for most people, be put forward as a serious story, because most people would think, well, if you were going to think up a story, surely there would be a more believable one than a policeman with a cat face or an old, you know, I think by its very nature, it kind of lends itself more credence because it's so insane. It really is. I can't think of another word for it. It's literally...
I hope you're taking that the right way, Simon.
That is the crux of all of these accounts, though, Simon. People want to know, do I believe this person? Do I not believe that person? That's what it comes down to. And for me, that is a very strange account. If you were making it up, you could have chose a better one. Put it that way.
Okay. Well, I'm not offended by your question because, look, I appreciate this is a planet full of humans. And humans have values which have been taught to them, which they've learned themselves. But the society, the structure, teaches its values, and the state puts its little emphasis one way or another. And it's very difficult for anybody to believe unless they've experienced themselves. Researchers who have researched the subject in detail won't be that surprised by it, because they will have interviewed many people, and elements of my account, I'm sure, would match things that they've heard. But if you're talking about just an average, decent member of the public, they would say, well, I can't cope with that. That's too unbelievable. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. You know, I'm not here to ram stuff down people's throats. What I'm here to do is to say two things. One, first of all, your government is lying to you. And the government does know an awful lot about extraterrestrials and is not being truthful with you. And secondly, I'm hoping there are other people out there who have had quite unusual experiences but are too frightened to come forward. And hopefully if they can see somebody who's prepared to put his head above the parapet and say, this is what I've experienced, they might then come forward. And who knows, in a few years' time, if enough people come forward, then just as we accept that there are greys, just as we accept that, you know, there are unidentified flying objects, if enough people come forward and bring elements forward that are, at this stage, are not accepted, in a few years' time there might be. So, yeah, I'm coming forward and saying this is what's happened. It is a very complex interaction. It is different. When I meet other people who have had experiences, you're right, Mark and Basil, they don't have that level of interaction generally. They're just taken, experimented on, and plonked back. Sometimes they're not even put back in the right house. And they're not often spoken to, they're not interacted with, and as a result of that, they feel disempowered, they feel victimized, so they won't come on and talk about it because they don't understand it and they're in conflict. Because I've had never hurt me. They've never, ever once hurt me.
Simon, yeah. We're running out of time for the televised section of the show, but we're going to carry on talking to you. So if anybody wants to hear any more of Simon's story, then please check out alternativefutureradio.com and you can listen to the continuation of this interview. But for now, Simon, thank you very much for coming back on the show to be with us, Simon. Thank you to everybody who's watching, and if you're listening to any more, then join us on the website. Okay, so those who are still with us on iTunes and the website and YouTube and everything else, we are continuing our journey.
Just for you.
Just for you, with Simon Parks, our continuing voyage. Simon, right, we were just discussing your account and how unbelievable it would sound to most people, the untrained eye, certainly. And I think it is the crux of all of these accounts that that most people want to know. Do I believe this person? Do I not believe this person? We interviewed somebody just last week who is a lawyer. Very wealthy man.
Henry Dayhut.
Yeah, Henry Dayhut. He's been on TV. He's been on news channels. He's written books on law. He's a very well-respected lawyer.
Got more to lose than to gain.
Very wealthy man. I imagine he wouldn't mind me saying so. Lawyers in America generally do quite well.
He's a consultant to other lawyers.
Consultant to lawyers, teaches lawyers things. Nothing at all to gain.
No.
Through coming out with an experience.
Everything to lose.
Everything to lose. And has lost some things, certainly.
Yeah.
And Simon, I would say that yourself would probably fall under the same kind of category. You've got very little to gain from talking about this. Some of the attention you're going to get and have got has not been positive, shall we say, at least. There's no money in being an experiencer. I don't think anybody's ever earned any money from doing it. As far as I can see, there's not really anything to gain.
Well, you see, there again, that's the problem because, you know, you're looking at it from a human point of view, which is quite acceptable because it's like gain. It's like money, power. And I'm not into that. That doesn't interest me at all. You're right. There's no money in this industry. You don't make money in this unless you're up in America, for goodness sake. And I've never done this because I wanted to either have fame or fortune. I've done it for the reasons that I've consistently put forward, that when I first realized what I was going through and I went to try and get some support, it just was non-existent in the United Kingdom at that time. And I felt that if I did the YouTube videos, it would allow other people to try and make contact so that they could realize that they weren't on their own. And it was also to say to people, you know, there's an awful lot going on which your government doesn't know about but is not talking to you. So I made a conscious decision to actually say, this is my life. This is what goes on. If people don't believe me, well, that's fine, because who knows, in 6 months or a year's time, other stuff may come out, which will lead them then to think, oh, you know, that guy perhaps was telling the truth. Or perhaps people will hear what I have to say and they'll go and do their own research on the internet or what have you. And that will lead them on a journey. And, you know, that's the point. If I speak to 100 people and 90 people are not interested, but 10 people go and start researching and go on their own personal journey, then that's good. So I'm doing it because I really feel that people need to have the other side of the story, that mankind is not the only intelligent race in the multiverse. There are other entities out there, and, you know, hopefully in the near future, they'll make an official contact.
Yeah, I certainly hope so, Simon. I don't think we're doing a particularly great job of it, so I hope somebody out there knows more than we do. But Simon, going back to your story then, you were talking up to the Starman. I think you said you were a teenager at that point.
You're breaking up really badly. I can just about. Did you say I was a teenager?
Yeah, you were discussing the Starman incident when you were a teenager. For anybody on radio listening to us, you'll realise that we have this every time we talk about anything to do with extraterrestrials. We have technical problems.
Okay. Well, you know, we don't have a huge amount of time, and if I try and give you my life story, well, that will be boring, and it would just take too long. So maybe if I could talk about the big one for me was when I made an agreement. I don't think I've spoken to you guys about this one. The 1971 experience I had.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, so it'll be 1971, I'd be about 11 and a half years old. I'm still at primary school, but I'm about to leave primary school for my next school. And I'm living in Preston Park Avenue, and I've got some friends, roughly my same age, who live two houses down. And it was normal for us every weekend to go and call for each other and go across to the park, which is right across the house. And this was a Saturday or a Sunday. And I called for my friends, and we went over to the park. Now, I was the only boy there. The two separate families living in this apartment block, and they had children, and they'll be different now because they're married. But one of the girls was Adrian Atkins, the other girl was Chloe Atkins, the other girl was Melissa Atkins, and then the other family was Sharon Lendrum and Tammy Lendrum. So those are the girls that I would always play with, go and collect. So we called for them. We all went across to the park. And I don't know which one of it was that spotted it first, but somebody said, look at that. And at about half a mile away, at about maybe 600 feet off the ground, was a silver object. Not a flying saucer, sadly. It was a teardrop shape, but if you imagine the blunt end going forward and the pointed end going backwards, and it was bright silver and the sunshine was reflecting off it, there are no windows, no wings, no noise, and it flew from north to south, because I know that because it was following the railway line, and then it turned towards us, and it was dropping all the time. And when it was about a quarter of a mile away and about 300 meters or yards off the floor, it sort of leveled off and came towards us, but it didn't come over our heads. Just before it got near us, it turned away, went back north-south because it had been traveling west to east, and then went along and then turned again away from us. Now it was traveling east to west, and then it disappeared over the horizon. But when it disappeared over the horizon, it was extremely unusual. If you have a DVD player and you do a freeze frame, or you advance one frame at a time, stop, go, so you can make the film go forward one frame, this appeared to me to suddenly go into stop, go motion. It was going forward, stop, mm-hmm. and it was disappearing over the horizon. There was just a point left. And as soon as the point had disappeared, I heard a propeller sound to my left. And I looked, and that's really odd because 1971, on a weekend, there shouldn't the sound. I should have heard that aeroplane a lot further, but it was just literally maybe only 100 yards to my left, and no word of a lie, it was flying at about 100 feet off the ground. It was just literally over the tops of the horse chestnut trees, the conker trees, where I would always go and collect my conkers for playing in September, October at school, and it was bright red. It was a biplane, and the most weirdest thing on God's earth, it had three huge cameras attached to it. These cameras were, if you think about your bathtub at home, double that size. So there was one camera on struts from one wing, and on the other opposing wing, camera on struts. And above the pilot's head was another bloody great big camera on struts. And this thing flew, you know, really, really low, and the pilot is in an open cockpit, and I have no memory of it flying over my head, and I have no memory of it flying after the UFO, because I, you know, that's what it was doing, and I didn't get a voice in my head, but I got a feeling, and the feeling was, don't worry, we're on to it, we're filming them, don't worry about it, don't tell anybody about this, this is special. And the next thing I remember is just my friends and I walking back, talking about the silver object. And the eldest girl, that's Sharon Lendrum, she would have been 13, she says, oh, that was a shooting star. And in my mind, I know that it wasn't a shooting star. And I'm about to say, well, it wasn't, it was a UFO. And I remembered the warning, which was, this is secret, don't talk about it. So I didn't say anything. But as we walked back, I said, well, what about the red aeroplane then? And they all looked at me and said, what red aeroplane? I said, well, the red Royal Air Force, because it had a Royal Air Force insignia. Nobody had seen this red aeroplane at all. And then I said, I just got this feeling there's a school up there, a school up in the sky. And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I sort of remember being with children up in the sky in their classroom. And they all just said, oh, you know, you've been silly and you don't muck around and all the rest of it. And we went back home and they told their respective parents who, well, one was a very strong Catholic and he got extremely upset about it. He said, it's a blimp, it's a barrage balloon. And the other family thought, oh, our daughter's seen a shooting star, how pretty. Now, when I went home and told my mother, she said, draw it. The first thing she said to me was, draw it. So I drew it. She looked at it and said, yeah, that's about right. Words to that effect, And that was it. Uh-huh. And for the next 6 to 8 weeks, all I did was do this drawing. I would do this drawing of this spaceship. And we never talked about it. Mother would never talk, but she was the only adult who believed me. Now, that's always the memory I've had. And as I approached, well, I was about 51, and there was a car crash outside the house. And it wasn't a bad car crash, and I looked outside, and there was a red bus, an old London red bus, which is used for tour guides. And I saw the red bus. Nobody was hurt. And suddenly, that red bus, in my mind, I saw that red biplane. And I thought, oh, that's odd. I'm remembering. That's the bit I remember. And the red biplane. But this time, in my mind, it actually flies above my head. And I think, oh, I've never remembered that before. And if you can imagine a very powerful vacuum cleaner, an industrial vacuum cleaner, and somebody stuck the nozzle on your chest and tried to, and you drew out, the best way I can describe it is draw out your insides, draw out what makes you you. And in my memory, I remember throwing my arms out to the side and my chest being arched out, and suddenly this great whooshing, flying feeling, and I'm at home now, and I stagger backwards and I put my hand on the sofa, and one hand on the sofa arm, the other on the cushion, and I sort of fall back and I'm gripping it. My eyes are wide open. I'm thinking, good Lord, this is happening to me, and flying, and in front I can see the red biplane, and it's getting nearer and nearer and nearer, and suddenly as I'm getting very close, it changes. It's no longer a red biplane, it's silver. But I must be so close to it that I can't really make out any shape. It's just like looking at a wall. It's bright silver, but the bottom bit does bevel away. And then I think, how am I going to get through that? And I've got no memory of going through the wall. I've got no feeling of that. The next thing I remember, I'm standing in this, I can best describe it as a cross-channel ferry. It's like open plan. And I'm standing there with my arms right out by my sides, and I suddenly feel very self-conscious because there are people about, and I put my arms down, and there are six tables in front of me, and on these tables are children, and on the right-hand side, and let's call it table one, they're all girls. There's not a single boy here. I'm the only boy, and the youngest one's about five, and they're sitting at this table, and this table is not held up by legs. It's just there. There's no legs holding it up, and These young kids, these young girls, they're drawing with crayons on paper. And at each table is an adult helper. They're all women. They're definitely not alien. They're human. These are women. And they're assisting the kids, and they're drawing. The next table, these children are getting older and older. Till the very end table, they're about my age. But these children have things around their necks. They're cords around their necks, and there's like a circular disc hanging, and they're all looking at these discs. And I stand there, and one of the young girls from the end walks up to me, right in front of me, and she says, we were told that you were coming. We've been expecting you. I am to wait with you until you're collected. And I say, where am I? And she says, school. And I say, am I coming to school? And she says, no, school is not for you. You're going up. And I say, what's your name? And she puts her finger over her mouth and says to me, with your mind, because I've been speaking with my mouth, with your mind. So I ask the same question in my mind, which is, what's your name? And she says, I am the gifted child. And I say, no, what's your name? And she says, that is my name, I'm the gifted child. And I say, well, what's that round your neck? And she says, that's my PED, P-E-D, PED. And I say, what's a PED? And she says, it's our personal educator device. And I say, can I look? And she takes a step backwards and says, it is not permitted to touch you. You're not coming to school. And I said, well, what's a PED? What does it do? And she says, it teaches us. And I say, what does it teach you? And she says, everything. And when I look at these kids, they're all sitting there with these discs, and they're touching them with their fingers, or they're making ah sounds or ah, and they're absolutely interacting with these discs. And then there's the teacher, and he's tall. His face is white. It looks like he's taken chalk and he's or flour. His face is pasty white, and he's got big blue eyes, and his hair is long and lank. His hair is fair hair. He's about 6 foot tall. He's very friendly. He's not at all aggressive. And what I learned was that the children on the right-hand side, the very young children, they've just literally arrived, and they're being deprogrammed because they're sitting there with their crayons and paper, because that's what they do in nursery and school. And that needs to be knocked out of them. They need to learn properly. So once they've progressed from that, they go to the next table. And as they pass tests, if they pass the tests, they go to the next table and they progressively work their way up. If they don't pass the test, then they leave the program and they go back onto Earth and all the rest of it. And I've always called this the school in the sky. And it was only through contact with Mary Rodwell, the very, very respected researcher in Australia, who said, well, she'd interviewed children and referred to it as the school in space. And I suddenly realized that this was one and the same thing. But I called it the school in the sky because I had no recollection of going into space. I'd been drawn up from the ground, just seemed to me like 100 feet. Now, this memory goes on and on and on. We haven't got the time for that. But that now explains to me why, when I was walking back with my friends, I said, well, what about the school up there? And they looked at me as if I was mad.
Simon, we're probably going to have to get you back on to talk about more of your experiences. I know you say you don't want to go on about it all day, but I think people might want to hear some of these, because there seems to be a hell of a lot of them.
The level of detail.
The detail is the thing. Simon, I've got one question for you before we let you go. All of this is happening to you, and one assumes to other people as well.
Yes.
What is your opinion, unless you know for a fact, what is the purpose? Why you? And is there a reason why it's you? Or what's it all about? Why are they doing it?
Yeah, it's a very, very pertinent question, and often people ask it aggressively. They'll say, "Why you? Why not me?" And I often say, "Well, you wouldn't want it to be you." The only answers I can give you are when I've asked this question, though not in the manner that you've asked it. It's about genetically, and it's about the soul. The soul that inhabits my body is not human. Mm. Absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. In fact, I had a recent hypnotherapist, a very well-known guy called Tom Ryan, who's goes to America and does lots of stuff, and he actually sent an email saying, I want to interview Simon Parkes because he's not 100% human. And he's the third person to tell me that. He emailed the Amash group, and I emailed him back and said, well, if you asked me in the first place, I'd have told you I'm not human. It's nothing new. But it's about genetics, and it's about the soul. So the soul in me has some importance to them. As far as I'm concerned, I'm just an ordinary person. There's nothing special about me, but clearly they're interested. And it's about hybridization. What I've been told by them is that they call me the two worlds son, the two worlds son. I can exist in this dimension and in their dimension. There are not many human beings that are capable of existing for long periods of time outside of the third dimension, but apparently I can. So they wanted for years my genetic material to construct hybridization program, so that when these hybrids are in the third dimensional reality, they can survive. So it's we haven't even got on to that part of it, but that comes later. But that's what I understand it to be, to do with genetic material, hybridization, and the soul that's inside.
That was actually why I asked the question, rather funny question earlier on about your father, because yeah. I have heard about this hybrid thing with you, and I'm just, you know, is the picture your father, or was your father perhaps alien?
I'm the clue.
Yeah.
Good answer.
The right answer.
Yeah, yeah. People who yeah. say I haven't got a clue, generally I think we have to give more credit to, because, you know, it would be very easy to make up an answer. And people who say I haven't got a clue, get my vote.
How are we doing for time?
I think we're probably about wrapped up. I think we've got to get you back for a part three, Simon, because the whole hybridization thing and the hybridization program people believe is happening, we definitely need to get your comments on that, because you've got a lot of insight.
Okay, my friends.
Okay.
Lovely. Thank you again, Simon, and we'll certainly book you again to come on and continue this.
I can't wait. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks, Simon.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Be safe.
That was Mr. Simon Parkes again.
Wow.
Yeah.
So for our iTunes listeners, just to explain, for the first hour of that, we were actually filming.
On telly.
We hope.
On telly, we hope.
We'll talk about it more on After Hours.
We will. The next After Hours.
The latest developments.
Oh, yes.
On the Alternative Future Radio front.
Oh, if you want to find out anything, just find us on Facebook. Go to alternativefutureradio.com. There's a little button at the top that says Facebook. Click on it. You'll come to our group. Join it. Bask in it.
Join the group. Say hello to us.
We'll say hello back.
Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like.
Request guests.
Request guests. Give us questions to ask the upcoming guests.
A lot of our guests post in that group.
They do.
You can literally just contact them directly. Because sometimes some of our guests have got so many friends on Facebook, you can't add them anymore or talk to them. But you can find them on our book.
Not only that, you can talk to myself and Mark there.
Yeah, there's us. Yeah.
There's the excitement.
Mark@alternativefutureradio.com. Basil@alternativefutureradio.com. Let's see who gets the most emails. Probably Basil, basically, based on previous experience, to be honest. Don't know why I set myself up for that one. Oh, popular Basil.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm inoffensive.
Well, yeah. Here lies Basil.
I'm fake.
Inoffensive.
Thanks ever so much. It's been the Out There Hour on Alternative Future Radio.
Thank you, everybody. See you all next time. Ta-ta.
Be good.
You're listening to Alternative Future Radio, home of the weird, resting place of the paranormal. We'll take you to the furthest reaches of the galaxy and beyond. Strange phenomena, aliens, psychics, cryptozoology, conspiracy, holistic health, and UFOs. Alternative Future Radio, where spooky just got weird.